Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
One final push before Election Day 2020. Where do we stand and what should Texans be looking for as returns come in tomorrow? All that and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown, reporters from our partners in Dallas, Houston, El Paso, and more with the latest on the general election as we prepare for a final vote and what many expect to be a long final tally. Also, the many issues voters will be deciding across the Lone Star State that often get squeezed out by the big banner headlines. A celebration of 20 years of life in outer space and the death of a very good machine puts some El Paso musicians in the international spotlight. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this November 2nd, 2020. I'm David Brown, and if you haven't voted yet in Texas, it's too late. Unless, of course, you plan to vote tomorrow. Election Day 2020 promises to be a line of demarcation in modern American politics on many levels, and so far more people have cast a ballot in Texas than the total number in 2016. But with nearly 1.8 million new registered voters added to the roll since the last general election, Texas still has a ways to go to match 2016's turnout. 59.4%. Over the weekend, the Texas Supreme Court tossed a Republican effort to invalidate more than 120,000 votes in Harris County. We'll have more on that in just a couple of minutes. But it was an event on I-35 between Austin and San Antonio that drew much of the nation's attention over the weekend. On Friday, a caravan of banner-waving Trump supporters surrounded a Biden campaign bus, shouting and honking horns. The Texas Tribune reports this rolling confrontation resulted in at least one minor collision and the cancellation of three scheduled events by Texas Democratic organizers, citing safety concerns. The FBI is said to be investigating. President Trump joined in the fracas remotely, reposting one of the many videos of the confrontation and following up with the tweet, "I love Texas," in all caps. Whether all this makes any difference in the outcome of one of the nastiest political seasons in recent memory is another matter. But you know it's bad when Ben Smith of the New York Times writes that, quote, "nothing good will come of reading political news, much less Twitter, between now and the election." But it is news we must cover. And today we are joined by three Texas journalists committed to getting the facts no matter where they lead. Joining us now from Dallas, Brett Jaspers, political reporter for KERA North Texas. Brett, welcome back to The Standard.
Thank you.
Angela Kochurga, news director for KTEP in El Paso and reporter for El Paso Matters. Angela, welcome back.
Hi, David.
And politics and government reporter for Houston Public Media, Andrew Schneider, joins us. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin there in Harris County. I mentioned the legal challenge over ballots cast through drive-in voting there. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is this morning there's actually going to be a case in federal court or a hearing in federal court for a parallel case to the one that the Texas Supreme Court decided over the weekend. It's the same people who were involved, Steve Hotze, who's a local Republican political activist, as well as two members of the state legislature, and one candidate for Congress, Wendell Champion, who's running against Sheila Jackson Lee.
The Republican plaintiffs are claiming that having drive-in voting is unconstitutional?
Exactly. They're arguing that it violates the state election code and that it violates the 14th Amendment. They're arguing that the fact that Harris County is carrying this out, trying to allow more people to vote in one particular place than other counties are allowing, violates the 14th Amendment.
I see. Well, as we know, Friday was the last day of early voting in Texas, record-breaking numbers statewide. Brett, what were the numbers like where you are? What are you hearing from election officials there?
Well, up here in all of the major four counties or the most populated counties up here, Dallas, Tarrant, Collin, and Denton counties, they all surpassed 2016 total turnout with what they've brought in 2020, early voting and the mail-in ballots that have been tabulated so far. So we are kind of mirroring the state up here within the big counties, and there's also quite a larger number of registered voters up here as well. So there's still some runway to go. Election officials told me last week that, you know, things went pretty smoothly during early voting. So I think they anticipate a relatively smooth day tomorrow. It's going to be a late night counting, at least for election day ballots that they are going to be counting, you know, once all the polls close tonight or
Angela,
tomorrow night, excuse me.
Tomorrow night, yes. Angela, I know El Paso is largely seen as a primarily Democratic city. What's turnout been like there?
Yeah, we're a pocket of blue in this big red state, and turnout again is surpassed the 2016 levels for early voting. And our population here is predominantly Latinx and young, and those are two groups that don't traditionally turn out. We have a lot of what would be called infrequent voters, voters who don't vote every time. We had a lot of new voters. And just huge numbers of people. One of the people casting a ballot on the last day of early voting was Khalid, the singer who calls El Paso home.
El Paso, though, more recently has been experiencing record-breaking numbers of COVID cases. And I'm curious, do you sense that that has had any effect on turnout there?
Well, you know, I did go out on Friday, the last day of early voting, and there were still people there, not as many. There are fewer people on the streets because we're at the stay-at-home order and shutdown order of the county judge. But again, local authorities have continued to reiterate that voting is an essential reason to leave home, but we'll see tomorrow. You know, early voting was steady up until the end, and the people I saw on the last day of early voting said they were committed to getting out there and they were not going to let fears about COVID stop them.
Andrew, did you see the lines sort of start to diminish as early voting went through? What was your observation of turnout?
Harris County broke through the entire record for 2016. Its previous record for all voting was just over 1.3 million. It tabulated towards the end of early voting 1.4 million. So there really wasn't much of a drop off over the course of the week. We've seen pretty strong turnout, particularly from younger voters, particularly from Latino voters. And it was pretty constant throughout the entire 3-week period.
You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people have been trying to tease out of these big numbers is who actually benefits from this early turnout. Is it the Democrats? I think that's a lot of the conventional wisdom. People energized by the issues leading up to and during this campaign season. But I want to ask each of you one by one, if you would share with us what you will be watching for most closely tomorrow into the day and the evening hours. I mean, is there something in particular, perhaps something that beyond the presidential sweepstakes that you're particularly interested in? And let's begin with you in North Texas, Brett Jaspers. What is it that you're going to be looking for?
Well, there are two counties up here that I think are very particularly interesting. One is Tarrant County, which has traditionally been a Republican county. Hillary Clinton lost it, but then Beto O'Rourke won Tarrant County narrowly in 2018. And there are also several close state house races in Tarrant County. So how Tarrant goes could mean a lot for the future of the state house. Then the second place I'm looking at is Collin County. Always been a GOP stronghold until very, very recently, maybe until this year. They've added about 150,000 voters since it was last redistricted. Also, there's some close house seats. So, you know, what do those traditionally Republican areas do? And we should see that, you know, by the end of the night, tomorrow night, because the early vote there has been so robust.
Andrew, let's loop back to you in Houston. What are you looking for in particular tomorrow as on the final day of voting in the general election?
Well, similar to what Brett was talking about, I'll be looking at Western Harris County and, more to the point, what's going on in Fort Bend County, which is to the south and west of Harris County. Those also have been traditional Republican strongholds. We saw in Western Harris County the 7th congressional district flipped in 2018. Republicans are desperately trying to recapture that. And Fort Bend County, we have the 22nd congressional district, which was held by has been held by Republicans for most of the last 42 years. It was previously held by Republicans Ron Paul and Tom DeLay. It's now held by retiring Congressman Pete Olson. And the Democrats have been making gains over the last several years, largely because the district has become so diverse. It also is a potential harbinger of things to come for the state as a whole. So mm-hmm. how that goes politically is it could be a measure of how things go more broadly.
Yeah, I think a lot of people wondering whether 2020 is the year that Texas turns purple or maybe tilts in the direction of the Democrats, depending on outcome. Angela, what are you looking for the election day proceeds?
I'm looking at turnout. Will it be affected by this shutdown? And also, we have a mayoral race. Our incumbent Republican Mayor Dee Margo is facing five challengers, so it's been a very hard-fought race, and people are keeping a close eye on that.
And of course, you should keep it right here for the very latest as Election Day 2020 unfolds across the Lone Star State. NPR coverage begins at 6 o'clock Central Time, 5 o'clock Mountain. We'll have a special report from Texas Standard featuring our reporting partners from across the state beginning at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. That's Central Time, 6 o'clock Mountain Time. And we encourage you to join us throughout the night as we keep you up to date on the facts surrounding Election Day 2020 in Texas. Brett Jaspers is with KERA North Texas. Angela Kucherga is news director for KTEP in El Paso. And Andrew Schneider is with Houston Public Media. Thanks to you all. Hope you're able to get a little bit of rest between now and Election Day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
And you can keep up with all the details 24/7 at texasstandard.org. Gonna be a busy Tuesday, absolutely. Joining us now, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. You ready for tomorrow, Wells?
Ready or not, I guess I don't have a choice in the matter.
I guess that's true.
Unsurprisingly, chatter about Election Day dominating talk on social media with ample anxiety ahead of tomorrow's big day. Lots of folks chiming in about that story you mentioned earlier, David, the so-called Trump train of trucks intimidating a Biden campaign bus on the Texas interstate. Via Facebook, Ed Sackett asks, why do Trump supporters think that violating traffic laws and endangering people on the highway helps their cause? And also asked, where were the police who should have been enforcing the law? On another note, Mario Modesto speaks for many when he writes, on a personal level, I'm glad the election is almost over. He adds, broadly speaking, I just want the country to accept the results either way. Time to move on for the good of the nation. We have to work hard to improve our current situation. And also via Facebook, Anthony White asks, what kind of America are we going to wake up to on November 4th, the day after Election Day? Just some of the takes out there, David. I'll be back with more reactions later.
Interesting comment. Accept the results either way. Are you ready to accept the results either way? Look for us, Texas Standard, on social media. Wells Dunbar looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise landscape and rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. So much attention concentrated on the top of the ticket in Texas. Voters aren't just deciding between President Trump and Joe Biden or that Texas Senate race between MJ Hegar and John Cornyn, of course. There are also school bonds to be decided, city council recalls, charter amendments that don't often make the front pages. Indeed, many, many more contests than we could possibly cover right here. But the Texas Standard's Michael Marks tried, at least.
Let me start by saying that this story will not be comprehensive. There are thousands of bonds and props and initiatives on Texas ballots. I'm not going to get to all of them. In fact, I'm not even going to get to all of them in Liberty. The city of about 8,000 people in southeast Texas has 42 propositions for folks to vote on, the product of a regular review of the city's charter. Some of the propositions are substantive, requiring city councils to be fully up to date on their property tax balance, for example. Others, less so.
Some of the corrections are really just commas, grammar, that kind of thing.
That's Casey Stinnett, managing editor of The Vindicator, Liberty's local paper. Elsewhere, the stakes are higher than comma placement. The Dallas Independent School District is proposing the largest school bond election in state history, over $3.5 billion, mostly for facility upgrades. Austin voters also have a big ticket on the ballot, a $7 billion bond that would expand mass transit in the capital city. They're not all so big, though. Fort Bend County residents will decide on a $38 million bond for parks. That's about the same amount that the Hampshire-Finette Independent School District would raise through their bond election. The district is about an hour east of Houston. The money would be used to replace and consolidate facilities at the high school, which is currently spread out among 9 buildings. According to Superintendent Dwayne Augustine, the main catalyst was the shooting at Santa Fe High School in 2018.
The question continuously came up, how do you secure this high school? We have all these buildings, kids go in and out. Why can't you lock the doors? You know, that sort of thing. And so the board knew that that was a priority with our community.
The district also has some structures that still need to be repaired from damage they sustained during Tropical Storm Imelda. So some of the money will be used for that. There are also plenty of propositions about local governance and bureaucracies. In Central Texas, voters in Kyle will consider whether to set up a police review board. There's a proposition in Laredo that would trigger an automatic recall election if a city council member is convicted of a felony. Texarkana voters will decide whether the city and its firefighter union will be forced to go into arbitration if they can't agree on a contract. In Coleman, 50 miles south of Abilene, there's a proposition that, if passed, requires the mayor to cast a vote in all matters that come before the city council. And outside San Antonio, in the rural community of Lytle, voters will have a say on whether to allow restaurants to serve mixed drinks. Mark Lovelace is the president of the Lytle Chamber of Commerce. He says the proposition could bring new businesses to an area that's already growing.
Think about restaurants like Chili's or Applebee's or those types of restaurants. Currently, we don't have anything like that. So if I want to take my wife out to dinner on Friday night, have a steak and have a drink, my options are extremely limited in this area.
Whether Lytle residents roll out the red carpet for Chili's is not the kind of issue that's going to make a lot of headlines on Election Day. But it's the kind of thing that makes a difference to the people voting on it. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. What should Congress do to help struggling Americans dig the country out of its economic doldrums? KERA's Christopher Connolly put that question to the two North Texas candidates who want to represent a longtime GOP-held congressional district that stretches from southeast Tarrant County through Ellis and Navarro counties.
Republican Congressman Ron Wright built his political brand over the last couple decades around fiscal conservatism. Even before he represented the 6th District, he was known as a deficit hawk. When he was elected 2 years ago, he planned to go to Washington to rein in spending and deflate ballooning national debt. So Wright certainly never expected to be sitting in the Capitol in March voting on a single coronavirus relief bill with a more than $2 trillion price tag and no real plan to pay for it.
That is exactly the kind of thing that I was prepared to go to Washington and stop. And then I find myself voting for all this debt.
Wright says these are unprecedented times and we need unprecedented action. So he wants Congress to authorize another round of aid for the American people. And the costs? We'll figure that out later, he says.
If that requires another $1 trillion, then we spend another $1 trillion. I don't like that, but that's kind of where we are.
Wright wants more stimulus and more help for small businesses. He wants to get people back to work and get the coronavirus under control. And his opponent? He wants to do all those things too.
Well, I think the number one issue is getting people back to work in the economy.
Stephen Daniel is a Democrat and an attorney. He practices law with Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins. Daniel lives in Maypearl, and he works in Waxahachie.
We need to make sure that if we're going to put people back to work, that we can put people back to work safely. If they need PPE, if they need testing, that we need to make sure that they have that.
Neither candidate is campaigning in person these days. Wright is being treated for cancer, and Daniel says it's too risky with COVID-19. Both men say we need another round of coronavirus relief. They're also both frustrated that it hasn't happened already, and they both mostly blame the other's party for a stalemate in Washington. One major sticking point, Wright says, Republicans want to make it harder for customers or workers to sue employers if they're exposed to the coronavirus. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says businesses must be shielded from a potential wave of frivolous litigation. And he pledged to block any relief package without these liability protections. Ron Wright accuses Democratic House leaders of playing politics by not including them.
If you don't have some kind of liability provision, you're going to see a lot of lawsuits pop up. I think that's shameful, but I think it's also a reality.
Democrats say they're open to some of those protections, but they don't want to give immunity to irresponsible employers who allow unsafe working conditions.
I would not give on that. I mean, if a business takes reasonable precautions, you know, that's one thing. But to give a blanket liability protection is not a good thing for workers.
This is nowhere near the only difference between the two men, of course. Daniel wants to increase the minimum wage, invest in broadband and in infrastructure projects that'll help address climate change. And he thinks the Trump administration's massive tax cuts should be rolled back, at least for the very wealthy. His main priority, he says, lower prescription drug prices and expand access to health care.
Everybody acknowledges that it's way too expensive. It's outrageous, especially here in this district and in Texas. We have the most uninsured people in the entire country.
Ron Wright wants to make permanent the 2017 Trump tax cuts and expand on them. He wants to continue rolling back regulations on businesses. After we've gotten past the coronavirus crisis, he says we'll need to take a hard look at spending cuts to address the $27 trillion national debt.
You know, we're going to do what's necessary to get the economy back on track, to get the economic growth back on track.
Now it's up to voters to decide whether to send Ron Wright back to Congress to do that work, or choose Stephen Daniel and a different agenda for the district. I'm Christopher Connolly.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Houston Democrats are blasting conservative Republican activists and candidates for seeking to throw out 127,000 votes cast at drive-through polling sites in Harris County. Speaking on Sunday, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee underscored the fact that all types of voters will be affected if the ballots are tossed.
These voters are Republicans, Democrats, Independents, new voters, senior citizens, families, and many others.
A federal judge is considering the legal challenge this morning, with the hearing set to begin now. It comes a day after the all-Republican Texas Supreme Court rejected the request to toss the votes. A grassroots campaign in South Texas has been using mariachi music to encourage people to head to the polls for the 2020 general election. Joaquin Guerra is one of the organizers behind Yo Voto y Grito.
For us in South Texas, it's like our turnout historically lags, you know, the rest of the state. So as just a fan and a lover of mariachi music and tradition, and knowing a few mariachis in South Texas, I reached out to them and said, hey, would you be interested in helping us turn out the vote? Just by using the tradition of mariachi.
Mariachi is performed at early voting locations in a variety of cities to entertain voters as they waited in line. Here's Mariachi Las Alteñas in San Antonio this past Friday. performances will also be held on Election Day in cities such as Edinburgh, McAllen, and Corpus Christi. As El Paso continues to face a surge in coronavirus cases, the city's mayor says a shutdown is not the answer. Dee Margo remains at odds with El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego, who ordered non-essential businesses to close for 2 weeks to slow the spread of COVID-19. Margo said Friday people need to be able to make a living.
Struggling families should not have to choose between following rules and putting food on the table.
The Texas Attorney General says Judge Samaniego's directive is unlawful because it conflicts with the governor's orders and has joined a group of restaurants in suing the county. And unemployed Texans need to show they're actively searching for a job this month to continue receiving unemployment benefits. The Texas Workforce Commission suspended the job search requirement in March at the onset of the pandemic. Recipients must show they've conducted a designated number of work search activities to qualify. More than 1.5 million people are receiving jobless benefits in Texas. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. NASA is celebrating a big anniversary today, 20 years since humans began living and working in outer space continuously, an achievement 227 nautical miles above terra firma, and thanks to the Johnson Space Center and the space industry, one that has Texas written all over it. One of the lucky few humans who's had a chance to live in the orbiting laboratory called the International Space Station, or ISS, is retired U.S. Army Colonel and NASA astronaut Douglas H. Wheelock, Ph.D. Colonel Wheelock, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks. It's great to join you. Thank you for the invite.
You know, before the ISS was a reality, the idea of a space station continuously orbiting the Earth was imagined as like a futuristic pair of rings joined by a center tube or something like that image from Stanley Kubrick's 2001, I'm sure you recall. What do you remember, though, of actually docking with the space station and your own first impressions on the first of your two visits to the ISS?
It's actually some really profound moments as we were approaching the space station. As it got larger and larger as we got closer and closer, I was just mesmerized by the size of it. You know, it was just amazing, and I thought, what an incredible feat to build this this orbiting castle in the sky. It was really amazing.
That's interesting. A castle in the sky. When you talk about how large it was, roughly how big are we talking about? How cramped were quarters there?
It's actually larger than a football field. Of course, a lot of that structure is the backbone or the truss segment with the solar arrays on it. And then the habitable part of it, it's quite large. It's like being in a four-bedroom home or something like that. But you could use the ceiling, the walls, the floor for your science experiments or to sleep on or what have you, you know. So,
you know, I have heard, though, that over the years, I mean, 20 years is a long time, certainly in technological terms, and some of the computers, you know, that were used 20 years ago are already outdated just by smartphone standards, right? I mean, in fact, it's my understanding you went up in your first mission to do some repairs.
Absolutely. We went up, my first mission on the Space Shuttle Discovery was in 2007, and it was actually during the construction phase of the International Space Station. So we took up the Node 2 module, and then we also moved a solar array from the center line. There was a frayed wire that tore the solar array, and we had to stop the mission and figure out a way to fix that solar array. So to be able to overcome overwhelming odds is just pretty incredible.
Did you have a scary moment at the ISS, or was it pretty chill?
You know, it was pretty scary being outside on the thing, because we're orbiting the Earth once every 90 minutes or so. And so in one 24-hour day, we get 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets.
Wow.
on the space station, which inside, it doesn't really affect you so much with temperature. But outside, in the direct sunlight, it's about 275 to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. And then when you go into shadow, that temperature plunges to about 275 to 300 degrees below zero. So in 45 minutes, we have about a 500 to 600 degree temperature change One scary moment that I had, I was in shadow when we were repairing this solar array. So for about 7.5 hours, I was in shadow. And so I was in 300 degree below zero temperature. And I couldn't close my hands. I started shivering and getting really cold. And I really kind of had a little mini panic attack. I was so scared that I wasn't going to be able to close my hands to be able to grab onto things. And so when it's really hot in the direct sunlight, some of those reflective surfaces on the space station can get really warm. And so there was a little bit of a sliver of sunlight on a piece of metal above me, about 10 feet above my head. Without being able to close my hands, I just sort of shimmied up the side of the space station and put my hands in that sliver of sunlight to warm them up. So it was a scary moment for me, and I was glad that I was able to warm my hands up and get back inside.
How close are we, in your opinion, to a day when humans, everyday men and women, will be able to live and work in space in perpetuity? I mean, do you think that there is such a thing that's on the horizon?
I think we're really close on the horizon for the space station visits. I think we really are. I have a little bit different philosophy on the. I know some folks talk about we need to go to Mars so we can propagate the human species on another planet. My initial response is, as if we take better care of Mars than we do of Earth, you know? So my own personal opinion is I would rather redirect all of our what we're learning in space to be able to take better care of our planet so we can use Mars and these near planets to do our research and how to take better care of our own planet.
Colonel Wheelock, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raisedyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It was January of 2019 that an eclectic shoegaze band formed in El Paso, Texas. Less than 2 years later, they're already receiving international recognition for a high-energy 8-song album called Death of a Very Good Machine. It all began when Rosie Varela wrote a song about her husband. He encouraged her to take it to Ross Ingram, who owns a studio called Brainville in town, and who Rosie had collaborated with in the past.
And I played it for him, and he's like, hey, yeah, let's do this, you know, so.
One song turned into several, with three other friends eventually joining the band, including drummer Lawrence Brown. Rosie, Lawrence, and Ross joined us from El Paso recently to talk about the new album and that first song called Hogar, which started it all.
Well, Hogar is it's Spanish for home, and it's about when you find a home with someone, when you feel, you know, totally understood and you feel at home. And so it was just a joyful song. The soundscape that Ross and I had envisioned was one that was immersive.
Did a lot of layering of guitars. There's a decent amount of keyboard, and we did a lot of atmospheric kind of things. And then, of course, you know, the shoegaze standbys of then dump everything into a giant reverb, so it sounds like you're in a canyon, or throw a bunch of delay on it, so it sounds like you're in outer space.
Yeah. Lawrence Brown, I want to bring you in here because the word shoegaze is often used in the context of this, but does that sound right to you? How do you describe the music that you're making?
I mean, first of all, it's really easy for me to play with these guys and create with them, and I feel like for me, I don't like being boxed in. I play a lot of jazz records. I played different percussion instruments and So when I came on the project, they said shoegaze, and I said, I have no idea what that even means, you know, frankly. And I said, okay, well, let me approach it from a different way and kind of bring the Mars Volta has some roots here in El Paso. And I said, well, what if I blend that with like some older psychedelia stuff, and then hopefully it'll fit. And if they don't like it, they can just tell me and I'll change it. But they seem to dig it, so.
We loved it.
We dug it, Lawrence. We really dug it.
Rosie, I hear the title of the album came about by a kind of happy accident.
It was actually a sad accident at the time. You know, I'm a DIYer, and so I found a product where you put in your iPad and, you know, you can plug in, you know, two guitars, two microphones. It's fantastic. And one day I was getting ready to work on a song, and I turned it on, and I think I played like one note, and it started smoking, and it started like making this really weird, like it sounded awful, but it also had a rhythm. So I thought, okay, before this thing melts down, I'm gonna record this. And that became the basis of the track Death of a Very Good Machine, because it was a very good machine, you know. It had recorded about 300 songs for me. Yeah, I brought it to Ross, and I said, yeah, this is kind of a weird sound, but you know, we're so weird that he dug it immediately. He was like, oh yeah, let's use this.
Part of this, though, seems to be that the members of the group are really diverse as well. I mean, you come from different generational sort of cohorts.
Totally.
Right? I mean, and as I read some of the articles about the group, it seemed like they were hanging a lot on the significance that some of you have been battling disabilities. And I wonder, given the attention that the band is getting, how much that factor being raised is problematic, frustrating, or welcoming?
That's a great question, Dave. You know, how much of that ends up getting factored into marketability. I've worked for different groups, you know, for the blind. I'm blind, and so I've worked in different kind of capacities. And at the end of the day, those groups are looking to, for lack of a better term, use, capitalize on, utilize maybe is a nice way to say it, the talents of folks who are blind or are differently abled. And I don't know what to say about that. I hope that the music stands the test of time, and I hope it doesn't become a thing where it's the 50-year-old lady and the blind guy. You know what I mean? But what I would say is, like, you know, if that is something that we have to address, you know, we should definitely address it.
It's part of our story in the sense that we did this as a really slow-roasted album. It took us 15 months to record and mix this album. And partially is, you know, there were some days I couldn't walk. And one thing that has come out of this that surprised me is how many messages I've received from people who have said, hey, I'm 60 years old, I can't walk either, but I think I'm going to start recording music.
Wow. I mean, to have that kind of impact on people right out of the box. You know, I think when people think of El Paso music, they, you know, talked about that larger-than-life landscape that you guys paint on this album. I wonder how much of the psychoacoustic sound, for lack of a better term, the psychoacoustic sound of El Paso kind of comes out in this music.
Well, it definitely, I feel like, you know, there's a couple of songs that really actually are about things that happened in El Paso. And the first one is Canal. Came into the studio with the intentions of writing a song on the fly. And so we started talking about what was going on in the news, and there was a very sad story about a father and a daughter who were crossing into the United States from Mexico, and they wound up drowning in a canal. And that image just stuck with us. To do it. you know, another song is called Can't Keep Hurting, and unfortunately it's about the El Paso mass shooting that we had, mm-hmm. you know.
At the Walmart,
yeah.
I think there's a, you know, El Paso's got this wide open feel to it between the mountains and the open desert, and, you know, sounds carry for miles. So I think that you go out in your front yard and you can see Mexico, you can see New Mexico, you can see the border wall, and it all may be miles away from you physically, but it still feels very close because everything's so wide open and you can, you know, kind of see almost into infinity if you look out towards our horizon.
So when we talk about musical landscapes, this one almost sounds literal in a sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
The new album is called Death of a Very Good Machine by the band Eep out of El Paso. It's been a pleasure to speak with three of the band's members, Rosie Varela, Ross Ingram, and Lawrence Brown. Thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for having us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, recognizing cancer caregivers during National Caregiver Awareness Month. With over 200 locations, Texas Oncology and caregivers can be right here for their patients. More at texasoncology.com.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
It's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Election season 2020 will be remembered as a game changer on many fronts, not the least of which the leap to more online campaigning than ever before, thanks to a certain pandemic. Conventional wisdom suggests this could be bad for voter engagement. But that hasn't stopped political groups from doing what they can to try to get out the vote, especially among young Latinos, in more unconventional ways. KERA's Alejandra Martinez explains.
Let's start with some music. This is the Dallas Latinx band Luna Luna. Kevin Gonzalez, their lead singer, was bummed when COVID canceled all their gigs. But then he started hearing from political organizations asking him to participate in online voter outreach.
The music itself might not have like a political message to it.
But Gonzalez, who's 25, says he liked having some part of the political process. You're hearing Luna Luna perform on an Instagram live concert called Rock the Reg, as in voter registration, put together by Move Texas. Gonzalez says it's all part of his band.
Just doing our part in trying to get as many people as possible to actually just hit the polls.
Younger voters like Gonzalez want to be politically engaged, something they can't do in person right now, but can do with the internet.
We have this new generation of voters that has arrived on the scene.
Stephanie Martin teaches political communication at Southern Methodist University.
And Generation X and baby boomers are wondering, how are these kids going to think and behave, and what is the impact of social media on that?
We know a bit of the answer so far. According to Tufts University, young Texans are leading the nation in voter turnout. Activist groups and political parties think it's partly because they're getting creative online and exploring new platforms.
Hi there! Head over to My Texas Votes to find out where to vote. And I'll see you at the polls.
You're hearing Tomas Rangel, social media strategist for the Texas Democrats, on their new TikTok account. Rangel's 20, is Mexican-American, and from San Antonio.
People recognize that there's a real opportunity here to connect and engage with young voters. Like Twitter, you post something and if it gets traction, it will get traction within those first 12 hours. But TikTok is wild because you can post something and then 3 weeks it will go viral.
More than half of TikTok users are 24 and under. The Texas Dems group Most Watched TikTok has reached over 755,000 views, which is a lot. Rangel's job is to create snappy videos.
Creating like easily digestible content. So stuff where we break it down a little bit, or maybe we can even go in depth into a certain policy issue.
He's posted explainer videos on voting and recaps of the debates. According to Martin, research says there's a correlation between voter registration and just online activity on TikTok.
Having to do with political engagement. The more online political participation that we see, the more likely we get a voting effect.
And don't think I forgot about the dating apps. They're taking part in voter engagement too. Chispa is a dating app just for Latinos, and this year it's encouraging singles to head to the polls. When Chispa users log in, they can join the app's election feature called Unidos 2020, or United 2020. Julia Estacolchik with Chispa says the app lets people select what's most important in the selection from a playfully phrased list.
Health care, because sana, sometimes not enough. For immigration, we call it immigration, but we're also saying because we are de aquí y de allá.
Then singles can use these as conversation starters.
If I'm swiping through and you and I, for example, pick the same topic, it will say that we actually care about the same.
Chispa's also collected data along the way. From their members in Texas who've opted into this feature, Estacolchik says 34% care about immigration and 25% care about racial equality. Those are things Kevin Gonzalez of the band Luna Luna cares about too.
It's a very important election, and you don't want to be looking back maybe 2 years from now and thinking to yourself, oh no, I don't like what's going on around me. I wonder if I voted, maybe something could have changed.
And he says he's hoping more young Latinos vote this year than ever before. I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hi, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, folks, talking about that lawsuit we mentioned earlier in the show, that suit from some Texas Republicans seeking to toss out over 125,000 drive-through votes cast in Harris County. As we noted earlier, it was dismissed by the Texas Supreme Court, but it is now landed before a federal judge in Texas. I believe that hearing just kicking off as I speak now. Interesting comment here via Twitter from Megnar. She asks, if it is so wrong, why is there no federal lawsuit in Corpus Christi? And provides a link there. Apparently Corpus, another Texas county that utilized drive-through voting during the early voting period here in Texas. So interesting footnote there to that federal challenge we're seeing today.
I guess the logic would be that if it were invalidated in Harris County, that it would be challengeable in other counties, and that you
wouldn't fight on
two fronts.
And really
anyway,
fascinating,
I think that's the logic.
Really fascinating overall what we've seen there in Harris County and the Houston region, and that real huge expansion of voting periods, around the clock voting. We famously had that midnight voting last week during the early early voting period. It's a really exciting stuff. Well, Election Day tomorrow, but some folks are already looking ahead to what may come. I think there's a lot of anxiety, not just about the election, but about the sort of the period between the election and the inauguration, regardless of whoever is declared successful. Via our Facebook page, Jonna Blackley says, what's on my mind is, well, now the really bad stuff begins. The next 2 months, he says, will be a political dumpster fire. And Jen Wireman says she is quite concerned about what the lame duck session may bring. Similar concerns from several other Facebook users, including James M. Wood. He notes the threat of civil unrest, especially with the president saying he will declare victory early before votes are counted. I believe James referring there to a report in the political newsletter Axios stating that if the president likes the early returns he sees on election night, then that would be indeed his plan to basically declare victory preemptively and take it from there. So lots of discussion about the media's role in here steering clear of anything like that, not declaring a winner too prematurely, because we've seen how that's played out. Obviously, echoes of 2000, Bush versus Gore. Mm-hmm. So, going to be a really interesting, really interesting evening tomorrow night, David. And of course, we're going to be covering it with some special broadcasts of our own.
Don't you know it? What we're going to do first, of course, is bring you the very latest in the morning, as we normally do when we go to air at 10 on most stations, Central Time. Not all stations, but most stations. And then we'll be back after NPR news coverage kicks in at about 6 o'clock or so, 5 o'clock if you're out into the El Paso area. And we'll be bringing you special updates with roundtables and expert opinion from across the Lone Star State on just how that final day of voting is going. And of course, as Wells was saying there, a lot will be in the tabulation. Everyone holding their holding their collective breath. It's going to be a very dramatic day and into the evening, and we hope you'll keep it right here for the very latest fact-based coverage of Election Day 2020 in the Lone Star State and across the United States. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.
If you want to know what's going on in the world, then you need to know what's going on in Texas. Every weekday on the Texas Standard, we bring you stories from across the state that affect what's going on elsewhere. As part of the NPR Network, an independent coalition of public media podcasters, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Michael Marks. Talk to you tomorrow.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.